So the first thing that we'll discuss today is accidental symmetries of the standard model. So you're familiar with the gauge symmetries of the standard model. An accidental symmetry is something that you don't put in by hand to the construction of the Lagrangian, but it's something that just arises automatically due to the gauge symmetry. So if it's not possible to write any terms in your Lagrangian that violate the symmetry, then the symmetry emerges as a global symmetry, and that's what's called an accidental symmetry. In the standard model, there are four accidental symmetries. They are a baryon number, denoted by B, and three lepton number symmetries, so lepton flavor symmetries. Which go under the names of LE, L mu, and L tau. The reason that these emerge is that it's just not possible to violate them at the renormalizable level in the Lagrangian. So in that case, these symmetries are symmetries of the theory to all orders in perturbation theory. They can be broken by non-perturbative effects. They can also be broken by higher dimensional operators. But as far as just talking about perturbation theory using the renormalizable Lagrangian, they are preserved. So let's talk about how these arise. So the first case that we'll write down is just baryon number. So the reason that baryon number emerges as a symmetry is that all quark fields in the Lagrangian have terms of the form Q bar I. Times some matrix, which I'll just call gamma, and qi, like this. And I should say it could have a different index, j. So here I and j are the generational indices, and gamma is some matrix that encapsulates the Dirac structure or flavor structure as well. So if this was, for example, the gauge interaction for the strong interaction, this would be like gamma mu, and then it would have some color matrix in the middle too. So because all the quark fields have to couple in this way with a Q bar and a Q, we can do a U1 rotation on the quark fields. So it's invariant under if all of the quark fields get rotated by the same phase. So I rotate every flavor of quark by the same phase. And then, of course, Q bar transforms with the opposite phase. So leaving all of these terms invariant. And then under this U1 transformation, the other fields, the lepton fields, all the other fields are just unchanged. So this U1 transformation is known as U1 baryon number, denoted U1B. And you define it such that the quarks have B equals 1/3. 1/3 is just a convention. But when you combine three quarks to form a proton or neutron, you have baryon number 1. So that's the reason why we choose that convention. So antiquarks have baryon number minus 1/3, and so on. All other fields, of course, are neutral since they don't transform under the symmetry. So the consequence of this is that the lightest baryon in the theory, the proton, has to be stable, because if it would decay, that would violate the global symmetry, this accidental symmetry. Okay. So the fact that protons are stable emerges as a feature or as a fact from the gauge invariance of the standard model. All right, so that was one of the symmetries. We also have these lepton flavor symmetries. So under, so there's three. The first one we'll consider is the electron lepton flavor symmetry. So this is similarly a U1LE symmetry. And under the symmetry, the electron gets rotated by a phase. And the electron neutrino gets rotated by a phase. But the other fields are invariant. So this is also a symmetry of the standard model. You can rotate the electron fields and the electron neutrino fields by this phase, and it's invariant. So we define that LE is equal to 1 for the electron and the electron neutrino. And it's equal to 0 for all of the other fields. And then in a similar vein, we have L mu, which is where we transform the muon fields and the muon neutrino fields. And so these fields have muon lepton number plus 1, and other fields are invariant. And then we also have L tau. So the tau and the tau neutrino have L tau equal plus 1. And then the other fields have L tau equals 0. OK, so all four of these quantum numbers are conserved in the standard model. To all orders in perturbation theory, under the assumption that neutrinos are massless. It's also useful to consider lepton number, total lepton number as well. So here we define lepton numbers for each of the individual flavors, E, mu, and tau, but you can define lepton number for all three flavors together. And so you have total lepton number, L, which is LE plus L mu plus L tau. Of course, since each of these three things individually is a symmetry, then total lepton number is also a symmetry. All right. So what does the U1L transformation look like? It just means that you rotate all of the lepton fields, E, mu, and tau, and their corresponding neutrinos all by the same phase universally. All right, so I just want to mention what happens when you add neutrino masses. Neutrino masses actually violate some or most of these symmetries. We know for a fact that neutrino masses have to violate individually the lepton flavor symmetries, just because we know that the mass eigenstates for neutrinos are different than their flavor eigenstates. All right, so that means all of these individual symmetries are violated by neutrino masses. But we don't know whether lepton number is violated or not. It may or may not be, depending on the mechanism that generates neutrino masses. All right. Okay, so that's all for accidental symmetries. So the next topic we're going to discuss for today and probably tomorrow and maybe some of the next day is deep inelastic scattering. Also known as DIS. So the question that we're going to try to address is that we have hadrons, protons, neutrons, which are baryons, plus also mesons, which are the physical states that we can observe. But the claim is that they're made of quarks. So the question is, how do we know that they're made of quarks? You have a question?
Isn't there one symmetry that is like not, well, it's CBT is different from other symmetries, but it's still the symmetry that's there that we can mention, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've completely omitted discrete symmetries, but those are also important. So there's C, P, and T, which are individually discrete symmetries. And in the standard model, all three of them play an interesting role. I guess it's kind of a longer discussion, but what ends up happening is that C and P are both violated by the weak interaction. And you can see that just because the weak interaction only couples to, it picks out left as opposed to right, which breaks parity. And similarly, for antiparticles, it picks out right instead of left. Okay, so it also breaks C. But C and P, the joint operation of both of those, is almost conserved in the standard model, but not quite. And I think, I guess in tutorial today, you'll discuss CP along with the CKM matrix? Yeah, okay, so perhaps in tutorial today, you'll touch upon the fact that CP is not actually conserved in the standard model, but there remains one parameter, which is the phase, one complex phase in the CKM matrix, which appears and is non-zero, in addition to the theta QCD term, which is also CP violating, but seems to be zero as far as we can tell. CPT, we think, has to be an exact symmetry. There are theorems that say it has to be true if you start with basic tenets such as causality and locality, you arrive at the fact that all quantum field theories must be CPT invariant. So.
And how important is locality in that story? Because in say, like, we're always assuming locality, but if you assume locality, then like everything keeps blowing up, so you need renormalization, which basically means you blur out like small distance details. So basically, you're not really assuming locality anymore.
Well, so it's a little bit nebulous exactly how one should think about it. But from the point of view of just writing down the Lagrangian, having a local theory just means that you're writing down operators that only depend on one point and don't couple different points together. So is renormalization inherently non-local? I'm not sure that it is, because you can always absorb divergences into local operators.
Are they still operators? Like, there's an infinite constant in front of all of them.
Yeah, are they still operators? They're still operators. Yeah, maybe we should continue.
You can write them down in the limits of lambda being infinity. You need to keep a cutoff at all times for any calculation. Then at the end of your calculation, you can maybe take it to infinity if you're lucky. But you can never start the calculation with lambda being infinity. You always need that cutoff, which...
Yeah, so you have to regulate what you're doing in order for it to make sense. I agree. Let me continue on, and we can keep discussing later. But I don't want to get too far afield. So here's what we're going to discuss. How do we know that hadrons are made out of quarks? And the thing that... I guess the real problem is that we can't unbind a quark from a hadron and study its properties because of confinement. So how do we prove that hadrons are made out of quarks? So this is the argument that we're going to go through. So to start with, let's consider an electron beam incident on protons. So this is just a cartoon of what's going on. We have an electron, and it scatters through the electromagnetic interaction. And it will hit a proton, like this. And so let's say that it hits one of the quarks. And if the photon has high enough energy, then that's a reasonable approximation. So it can give one of the quarks, let's say, a kick. So let's say the U quark goes over here, and it leaves the D quarks to be recoiling over here. So due to the fact that quarks are confined, it takes an infinite amount of energy to separate one quark from these other two. So it's energetically favorable to pull out a QQ bar pair from the vacuum to form color neutral objects. So due to some gluon interactions, you'll form a quark antiquark pair like this. And so you might have a D bar like this, and let's say a D like that to form, let's say, a neutron. And maybe these two quarks have a lot of energy still, and they want to fly apart. And so again, you pull off another QQ bar pair. And so you might have something like this, UU bar, U D bar like this. And so here you'll have mesons, pions or rows in this case. So this is just a sketch, but you can get the idea that, well, you might form lots of these different objects. You have a question?
That's not a neutron.
Maybe. Oh, yeah, not a neutron. What did I mean to draw? This is not even a proton. I should have had a U here. Thank you. So this process is called fragmentation or hadronization. It's the fact that if you give one of the quarks a kick, you'll end up producing lots of hadrons. You don't separate it. So this process. So the reason that this occurs is due to the fact that the beta function of QCD is negative. So you may have calculated in QFT that the coupling constant alpha s, which is gs squared over 4 pi, as a function of energy, goes down, which means that if you go to lower and lower energies, it eventually blows up. And at some point, you can calculate a perturbation theory, it goes to infinity. And the point at which it diverges is the Landau pole, which is an energy scale denoted by lambda QCD. And numerically, it's around 200 MeV. Okay. So this tells you that at energy scales comparable to lambda QCD, hadronization occurs. Where the coupling constant, alpha s over 4 pi, is of order 1. Okay. So you can also think of this as occurring over a particular distance scale. So you can think of hadronization occurs over distances lambda QCD inverse, which is around 1 femtometer. And so again, it's no surprise that the proton radius is also around a femtometer. That's a typical length scale for hadrons. Oops. Oh, wrong board. So the way to kind of interpret this cartoon is to say that, well, my up quark can get a high energy kick, and then once it goes a distance of around 1 over lambda QCD, it starts to notice that it should form hadrons. And so at this point, it pulls out a QQ bar pair from the vacuum and forms other hadrons. And then if they go keep flying apart and it travels another femtometer, then it'll form more hadrons. But there's a flip side. Of confinement. Which is known as asymptotic freedom. This is just saying that, okay, if I go to high energies, the coupling constant will decrease. It will get smaller. So this tells us that at distances, much, much smaller than the QCD scale, quarks behave as free fermions. And perturbation theory is valid. Alpha S is much, much smaller than 1. All right? So when you combine these two things, it implies an important result which goes in the name of factorization. And stated in words, factorization just means that what happens at small distances isn't affected by what happens at large distances. The reason that factorization is true is the reason that it's possible to make any sort of prediction involving collisions with hadronic particles. For example, at the LHC, they're colliding together protons, and they're producing lots of hadrons. All right. So is it possible to compute anything about this without understanding from first principles what the initial state of quarks inside the proton is, and also how you produce hadrons? What are the details of fragmentation? It is. So that's it is possible, and it's due to factorization. So we're going to see how this works in a little bit of detail. But in a nutshell, factorization is just telling us that the details of the strong interaction will determine what the initial state of quarks inside the proton is. And the details of the strong interaction will tell us how quark with a given energy will hadronize to form some final state. But if we just focus on what occurs over very small scales when this collision occurs, we can treat the up quark in the proton as effectively a free fermion for computing this cross section. So that's what it means. All right. So now we're going to go through kind of a long calculation to show how this works in detail. And what we're going to do is consider proton scattering in general. So I'm going to assume that we know nothing about the fact that protons are made out of quarks And we're just going to try to compute the scattering cross-section as best we can. And some things, of course, we can't compute. And so in those cases, we're just going to parameterize our ignorance in terms of functions. Then we're going to come back to the same calculation, knowing what we know about the fact that protons are made out of quarks. So here's the Feynman diagram that we want to compute. So we have an electron going in, an electron going out. And it scatters with a proton by exchanging a photon, which has momentum q. And I'll write the momentum of the electron as L and L prime for incoming and outgoing. But then when the photon hits the proton, it fragments the proton into potentially many hadronic states. So we could have many hadronic states in the final state. So I'll just label them by 1, 2, 3, up to n. And collectively, I'll just denote this by h as our arbitrary hadronic final states. And so the proton will initially have momentum capital P. And the outgoing hadron will have total momentum P prime for the final state. So this will be a sum over all of the outgoing momenta, P prime I. Okay. All right, so L mu is the initial electron. L mu prime is the final electron. P mu is the proton, initial proton. And P prime mu is the final hadronic momenta. And then Q is L mu minus L prime mu is a momentum transfer. All right. So we're also going to set ME to be equal to 0, assuming that the energies involved are much larger than the electron mass. So before we begin and try to compute anything, it's very helpful to define some kinematic variables. And there's a bunch of them, so I'm just going to define all of them. So the first one goes in the name of q squared, which is minus little q squared. So this is also known as the momentum transfer, but perhaps more appropriately, it's the momentum transfer squared. The reason that you define it with this minus sign is just because the fact that little q squared is always negative, so positive q squared is always positive. And you can see this just by plugging it in. This is minus L prime squared. So I expand this out. This is 2L dot L prime, which is 2 times EL, EL prime, 1 minus cosine theta, where theta is the scattering angle. For the electrons. All right, so it's always positive. The next variable is called nu. Nu is defined as in the following way. It's capital P dot Q divided by the proton mass. So what does it mean? The interpretation comes from taking the rest frame of the proton, the initial state proton. And so you should think of that as sort of the quote-unquote lab frame. We have a fixed target. It's composed of a block of stuff. The stuff is made out of protons. That's the lab frame in which it's at rest. So in that frame, capital P is just the proton mass, 0, 0, 0. And so P dot Q is just P times, oh, sorry, MP times EL minus EL prime. So in that frame, nu is just EL minus EL prime. So the interpretation of nu is just the energy transfer in the lab frame. All right, so next variable is called y, and it's defined as p dot q over p dot l. So, okay, what does this one mean? Let's go again to the lab frame. So p dot q is just mp, and then we have EL minus EL prime, and then this is MP EL. Okay, so this cancels here. So this is EL minus EL prime over EL, or 1 minus EL prime over EL. So the interpretation of Y, it's the fractional energy transfer in the lab frame. All right, so the last variable we have is known as x. And it's defined as minus q squared over 2 p dot q. Or I could write it as capital Q squared over 2 p dot q. Or I can use the definition of nu and write it as q squared over 2 mp nu. Okay, so those are all the same. This is also known as Bjorkane x. After the guy that wrote it down. So let's see what the meaning of x is. What does this mean? So first, let's consider the case of elastic scattering. Elastic scattering just means that the initial state particles are the same as the final state particles. And so this final state hadronic particle X, or collection of states H, should just be the proton for elastic scattering. All right. And we're also going to use the fact that we have momentum conservation. So we have P plus L is equal to P prime plus L prime. And so let's compute the following quantity, P prime squared. Since I only have the proton in my final state, this is just MP squared. And by momentum conservation, this is P plus L minus L prime squared, which is P plus Q, quantity squared. And now I can expand this out. So I have MP squared plus 2p dot q plus q squared. So this tells me that 2p dot q is equal to minus q squared, which is capital Q squared. So now I can just divide both sides by 2p dot q, and I have q squared over 2p dot q is equal to 1. So this was what we defined as x. So in the case of elastic scattering, x is always equal to 1. So now let's consider the case where we have inelastic scattering. So in this case, now we have not just the proton, but some collection of hadrons in the final state. And so let's compute the same, go through the same argument that we did over there. So let's start with p prime squared, which I should think of as p1 prime plus p2 prime plus dot, 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 plus pn prime squared. And so if I factor all of this out, I'll have some sum over the masses. Plus cross terms, which take the form, for example, of like 2p1 prime dot p2 prime, et cetera. All right? And so on the left-hand side, I can go through exactly the same argument, just expanded as I have here. So this is equal to mp squared plus 2p dot q minus q squared. So then I can write the following. P prime squared minus mp squared is equal to 2p dot q minus q squared, and this is equal to 2p dot q times 1 minus x, just using the definition of x. All right, so now if I look on the left-hand side, p prime squared always has to be greater than the proton mass squared, all right? And the reason is due to conservation of baryon number. If I start out with one baryon in the initial state, I need at least one baryon in the final state. I could have more, but I need at least one. And so that means that the proton mass squared, or the neutron mass squared, plus all of these other positive terms that contribute to p prime squared minus the proton mass squared will always be a positive number. All right? Also, this number here is also positive, since it's just related to nu. So this quantity here is 2 times nu mp. This number is also positive. So that means that 1 minus x must be positive, or x has to be less than 1. Also, q squared must be greater than 0. As I told you, it's always positive. It's only 0 if cosine theta is equal to 1. So that tells you that must always be positive. This tells us that x must also be greater than 0. So when you just combine these two things for inelastic scattering, x can take values in the following range. it has to always be between 0 and 1. So if you thought about it in generality, combining both elastic and inelastic, it has to be less than or equal to 1. I guess this could also be equal to. OK. And it only saturates the upper limit for the case of elastic scattering. All right. So let's recall something about 2-to-2 scattering. And this would be the case of elastic scattering. When you compute the differential cross section, d sigma by d cos theta, it only has one variable, independent variable. Once you specify the initial state. So that means that if you want to compute the differential scattering rate, it only depends on, for example, cosine theta, or equivalently, the Mandelstam variable t. Which are equivalent to one another. But this is in addition to the center of mass energy squared, which is S, which comes into the initial state. But once you specify the initial state, there's only really one extra variable that the cross section can depend on. And so you can take that to be t or cosine theta, whatever you prefer. U, for example, of course, is related to S and t. So similarly, for elastic scattering, that's also 2-to-2 scattering. And so again, there's only one independent variable. And you can take that to be either q squared, or nu, or y, or cosine theta, or t. Those are just different statements of exactly the same kinematic dependence. You can relate one to the other. This is in addition to S. All right. But now when you go to inelastic scattering, now we have more independent kinematic variables on which the cross section can depend. It has two kinematic variables. So the first one will either be q squared nu y dot dot dot. And the second one can be taken to be x. So for elastic scattering, of course, x is always just equal to 1. But now, if we have inelastic scattering, it can depend on an extra kinematic variable. All right. So now that we've defined all of the kinematic quantities that we're interested in, now we're going to try to compute the cross section for electron-proton scattering. So here's what we're going to compute. So our initial state is electron proton, and then it's going to scatter to an electron plus an arbitrary hadronic state, which I'll denote by x. And what we're going to compute is what's called the inclusive cross-section. So we're going to include in our cross-section all possible hadronic final states. And so I should write this as a sum over all the final hadronic states h of the what's called the exclusive cross-section, which is the scattering cross-section for a given particular hadronic state h. So here is the cross-section formula. So I'm just writing out what the formula is. We have 2 over the initial energy for the electron times 2 for the initial energy of the proton, and then times the magnitude of the relative velocity. Then I have to do a lot of momentum integrals. So I have d3 l prime over 2 pi cubed. 1 over 2 EL prime. Then I have to integrate over one momentum integral for every hadronic final state. So this will be, I can write that as a product over from 1 to n hadronic final states. And then I have a momentum integral for each. And then I have energy momentum conserving delta function. And then I have summing over the matrix element squared. And I'm summing over spins. And then I have to average over the initial spin, so I divide by 1/4, because spin 1/2 and spin 1/2 for the electron and the proton. So this is the complicated thing I want to try to compute. And again, we don't know how to compute exactly the process of hadronization. And so we're going to try to parameterize the things we don't know. So here's the matrix element. So the electron part is straightforward to compute from QED. I have a U-bar spinner for the outgoing electron. Then I have an IE gamma mu, and then a U-spinner for the incoming electron. The photon propagator is minus I over T squared. And then the interaction with the photon of the hadron is something that I don't really know. And so all I can do is just write down a quantum mechanical matrix element, a transition operator that goes from the proton state to the hadron state, inserting the photon current, the electromagnetic current, which the photon couples to. So I should write I, E, and then J, electromagnetic current, index mu. So what is the photon current? Electromagnetic current, I should say. So all I want to do is pick out the electric charge and then sum over the current operators, like so, with their corresponding electric charges. All right. Of course, it's through this current that the photon couples in the underlying Lagrangian. But the thing that I don't know is how these collection of operators causes a transition from the proton to the hadron. So we don't know in general how to compute this matrix element. So that's not going to stop us. All right. Maybe I should mention also, what you should really put in here is actually the Fourier transform of this operator. So I'll just mention that. Now, since we have this form for the matrix element, I'm free to square it, even though I don't know what everything is. Sum over spins, matrix element squared. So I have e to the fourth over q to the fourth. I have a 1/4. Then I have some traces. So the lepton part, which comes from squaring the gamma mu u, just looks like L slash prime gamma mu L slash gamma nu. And again, I'm neglecting the electron mass. Then I'm just going to square the hadronic part. And so I just have the matrix element. Times its complex conjugate. The operator itself is Hermitian. Okay. So now let me just plug this mess into this mess and expand it into an even bigger mess. So I have 1 over, okay. So I'm going to group the terms together a little in a kind of a peculiar way. And so I'm not writing down this term. It'll appear later. And then I'm just going to pull out one factor of 2 pi out front. And then I have the electron, outgoing electron momentum integral. Then I'll have a factor of e to the fourth over q to the fourth, factor of 1/2 times the trace of L prime slash gamma mu L slash gamma nu. Okay, and again, I'm picking out particular factors to factor out differently, but it'll be equivalent. And then I have 1 over 2 EP, sum over hadronic final states. What I want to compute is this one. And then I have this pi from 1 to n, final state hadronic integrals. Then 3 momentum conservation, delta 3. Yeah, 2 pi cubed, which is one of these. It's just convention why I'm factoring out one versus the other. Then I have 4 momentum conservation, L plus P minus L prime minus sum over the final state momenta. And then I have 1/2. Sum over the spins, all of the remaining spins, the hadronic spins, times this thing I don't know. Okay. So there's the big mess. And I pulled out particular terms in certain ways. Yeah?
You're talking about a proton here, and like, we all know what a proton is, like generically, but made from quarks, what kind of state is that exactly?
Yeah.
Like it's not just a vacuum state that you work on with like creating three quarks, because it's like some
right.
weird bound state.
They have a particular wave function.
And
so we're not putting in the wave function of the proton, but you're right. In general, it has a complicated wave function.
But do you? Is there a way of figuring out what the wave function is exactly?
Yes, there is. It's an experimental question, or it's a question for computer computations. But right now, we're not saying anything about that.
Mm-hmm.
We're assuming that it's just in some particular state, and we're just acting on it with this operator to get some other bound states as well. And so we're not saying exactly what the wave function of this state is or the wave function of those states are.
Are we going to talk at some later point about how exactly?
Yeah, it'll come in probably tomorrow. So it's part of this whole argument. You'll see how we'll get there. But for right now, we're assuming complete ignorance about what this is. All right. So I just want to mention it's a little bit ad hoc, factoring out particular terms and grouping them together like this in a certain way. The reason I did that is just based on convention for what other people have chosen. But the idea is that we're just going to call all of this big mess here on the second and third lines some unknown function. And it has two Lorentz indices, mu and nu. And so we need to call it something which also has two indices. And we're just going to call it w mu nu. So all of the unknown hadronic physics based on not only the initial states, but the details of hadronization and then summing over all the different hadrons is all lumped together into this big function, which we have no idea how to compute in general. So this is all the unknown hadronic physics. So the first part, what we're going to do is we're going to evaluate the lepton part, the trace involving L and L prime. So we can define a leptonic tensor, L mu nu, which is defined as 1/2 the trace of L slash prime gamma mu, L slash gamma nu. And so this whole thing is just 2 times L mu L prime nu. Oh, I should be careful here. L nu L prime mu minus L dot L prime eta mu nu. OK, so there we go. That's the lepton part. And then we want to contract that into W mu nu. So what is W mu nu? So in general, we don't know how to compute it. But we can use Lorentz invariants and also other symmetries to restrict the form that it can take. So here's the part that we're computing. We have our initial momentum p, we have our final momentum p prime, and then we're injecting some momentum transfer q. So this object w mu nu can only depend on p or q, and it can also depend on p prime, but p prime is just a linear combination of p and q. And so it only depends on these two momenta. All right. The other thing is it doesn't depend also on the particular details of the hadronic final states, because ultimately we're summing over all of them. All right. And so we just want to consider what sorts of objects we can generate from these two momenta that can also have two indices, which could be W mu nu. So W mu nu can contain terms of the following form. So there's eta mu nu. That's an object you can generate with two indices, of course. You can have P mu, P nu. That's allowed as well. You can have Q mu, Q nu. We could have P mu, Q nu. We could have Q mu, P nu. And then lastly, we can have epsilon, mu nu, alpha beta, P alpha, Q beta. All right, so only some of these are allowed. All three of these will vanish when you contract them into here. Because if you contract Q with either mu or nu into this object, you'll get zero. So these things don't contribute. This object here also has to vanish as well, due to the fact that the electromagnetic interaction conserves parity. This would be a parity odd interaction. Whereas electromagnetism is parity even. Is it obvious that this is parity odd? Maybe it's not. So you can imagine what would happen if you contracted this into here. You'll get a product of four different momenta all contracted together with the epsilon tensor. And so the epsilon tensor will force one of those to be the energy and three of them to be spatial momenta, right? Because you need to have 0, 1, 2, or 3. So under parity, all of the spatial momenta will flip sign, but the energy stays invariant. So under parity, it'll flip sign, right? So the most general form we only need to include those two terms as far as their Lorentz structure. But we still don't know the coefficients, the overall coefficients. So the most general form for W mu nu, which depends on P and Q, is can depend on eta mu nu, and it can depend on P mu, P nu. And again, it should have arbitrary coefficients, which are functions, before each. Let me just write this down, and then I can answer your question. And so we're going to call this coefficient minus W1, and this coefficient will be W2, and then for convention, we're just going to divide by MP squared, I guess so that W1 and W2 have the same mass dimension. So W1 and W2 are Lorentz scalars, and so they only depend on other Lorentz scalars. So these would be, for example, W1 and 2 could be functions of, let's say, x and q squared, for example. All of the kinematic variables we defined, q squared, nu, y, and x, were all Lorentz scalars. OK, so we'll stop here, and then we'll continue tomorrow. You have a question?
Yeah, so why exactly do those two terms vanish? You said something like when Q is contracted with mu, but I don't know what it means.
Yeah, so if you contract Q, so if you just take this one, let's say Q mu, contract it with this, you get zero.
Why?
That's the claim. Is it true? I hope so. So you just have to use the fact that Q is L minus L prime. So that's the claim.